Dead Air is inspired, as I said, by a text called On the Minute by Walter Benjamin. And in this essay, it's about a radio host who wants to conclude his lecture, his on-air lecture, exactly on the minute, but has a problem with the clock and then ends up having too much time and having dead air. Why did you want to use this text to create your art?
Well, I know when I read the text, I didn't really... it kind of was an idea that grew out of a few things that I'd been thinking of, and it kind of I stumbled on the text by accident, really. Or I guess not by accident. It was part of research that I was doing when I was doing my master's in fine arts the last couple of years. And for me, it was a really... I mean, the text is only... It's only about 2.5 pages long, so it's really brief, I guess, as a lot of his writing is. But for me, it was interesting that there were so many ideas that he was talking about that... were connected to ideas that I was starting to sort of formulate my thesis around. Primarily things like technologies around that time, turn of the century, late 1800s, that were really radically affecting people's day-to-day lives and experience, and sort of where those technologies emerged from and just the impact they had on daily life. And my background is in radio art. I mean, I was a punk rock kid, but... when I heard radio art and found out there was such a thing as radio art, it was kind of the first moment, I suppose, that I started to think in terms of sound outside of, you know, maybe playing music, and that sound could also be an art form that may or may not be music. But so I've always been interested in radio. And then when I was in my 20s, I used to do a lot of volunteer work for one of the guerrilla radio stations in El Salvador during the Civil War. So just sort of all of these ideas kind of came together, and so much of it was sort of discussed either directly or indirectly in that text. So I just fell in love with it pretty instantly, and then the sort of idea just kind of folded out from there.
I really like the essay, and I really... I think as both a someone who listens to a lot of radio and as someone who produces radio for a community station, I really related to the fears in it, the fear of having not enough time and also having too much time, mm-hmm. and the need to balance it. And after I read it, I looked into Benjamin's radio work and saw that he had done a lot, but it was state radio,
right.
Which was... You know, much different, more different than my experience. Very, right. Very controlled.
It was German state radio.
Yes, yeah, Weimar state radio.
Right.
And it led me to think, you know, in terms of how we see time, and you know, whether it's that we feel we own our time slot on radio, or that we have to use it well. Do you think it's affected by the type of radio station, whether it's state controlled or community, or?
Well, I think the biggest factor there is whether you're at a radio station that identifies their mandate as making money or making good radio. So, I mean, commercial radio is primarily concerned with packing in as much advertising dollar as they can and then attracting as many listeners to listen to the ads. So I think that there's sort of a really exaggerated emphasis on time and radio and our experience of radio, so much to the point that they've developed software that will actually condense the space in between announcers' words so that there's actually more time for advertising. Whereas with state radio, there's not so much an emphasis on advertising dollars, but I think that commercial radio still has an impact and affects CBC, for example. And I think CBC is often expected to kind of be in response to commercial radio in some ways, which is, you know, kind of, it's ridiculous. But I think there's still, that's probably a reality for them. But I know that even when I used to do a program here on CKUW, there was, you know, if you accidentally forgot to cue something or whatever, you would have this sort of moment of kind of panic, and I guess your grace as a host would determine how that would come out for listeners. But I know that even when there was no pressure of making mistakes or advertising dollars, that I think inherent in the technology is this, and also because it's completely oral, there's no visual, so to sort of take away sound on the radio is really dramatic, you know, and I mean, obviously, maybe an interesting thing is that can be used to a dramatic effect. But if it's an accident, which is what happened with Benjamin when he was doing his radio, and he was so excited about doing that program in part because it was a really good paying gig and he needed the cash. So he didn't want to screw up, and he accidentally sort of, you know, ahead of time prepared really well to finish exactly on time as the German producer indicated he should. But he just read the clock wrong, and then he started packing up his things and was wondering why the producer hadn't come back. And when he realized he read the clock wrong, and in fact, the whole time he was gathering his papers and his jacket, he was broadcasting nothing. And he described that as an actual terror, and he wasn't being he wasn't exaggerating. It really was a moment of sheer terror for him, and he described the feeling as immediately feeling like his life was being sucked away into thousands of homes across Germany. So it was this really dramatic event for him. And I think that's sort of, you know, I mean, obviously Benjamin writes a lot about our experience of technology and how technology changes us and how we change technology. I can't even remember what your question was anymore.
I bet you definitely answered it. Another thing I was thinking about, just in terms of the dead air, and in his case, there were sensors that could take you off the air. But, you know, in my case, and in a lot of radio stations, we are regulated, and there have been cases where, you know, if stations have too much dead air or inappropriate programming, the CRTC can pull your license, or, you know, less drastic, your listeners can turn you off.
Right.
So that fear is still there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the other thing he was thinking about, whether it was related to the censors, or, you know, to the political situation in Germany, that if it was inappropriate,
yeah,
you might be completely dead.
Yeah. Well, I think it was all of those things. And I mean, I think we also have to remember that, like, he was talking about this experience of radio in, when did this event, it was, I think, in between World War One and World War Two. So, I mean, at that time, these technologies were still pretty new to people. They hadn't grown up with them for generations, mm-hmm, like we have. So it also wouldn't be the same experience of dead air for us now as it maybe would be for him. Or people listening at that time. So, that, you know, your point in history always is sort of playing into that, mm-hmm, context as well.
The exhibition looks at time and timekeeping, not only in radio, but also more broadly, as a coordinated global means of control and coordination. How did the global coordination of time, you know, things like the creation of Greenwich Mean Time, affect world capitalist powers in the late 19th, early 20th century, in 30 words or less? No. Yeah, no.
Well, it was one of the things I had to do, but one of the things I was researching at this point in time was sort of this desire to incorporate universal time, because up until, oh, when was it now? I'm going to say 1884, but that might not be correct. There was no universal time, so you could have a village in England and two or three villages over, which was not very far in terms of kilometers, but they would be on a different time. If you took a train from Chicago to San Francisco, you used to pass through 40 time zones, because it was, you know, up till that point, it was based on people's relationship to their physical location and that relationship to the sun. So I think that it was kind of with train travel that there was this realization, I guess. It wasn't just it wasn't a fluke. I mean, there was this realization that with train travel, we needed to have a coordinated time. Otherwise, you couldn't get goods from one city to another, or people couldn't catch the train on time. So it was kind of this industrialization that was driving this desire to establish a coordinated time. And by industrialization, I guess I really mean capitalism, was sort of this force behind this, which in some ways, I mean, I'm not sort of advocating that we go back to uncoordinated global time, but it really was this moment where, sort of on a really broad sense, capitalism had this really direct impact on our relationship to each other and our communities in terms of, you know, you could look at it in one sense that our local time was obliterated by capitalism. And really the only reason for that was this change to industrialization. So I mean, it was definitely one of those things I was looking at. And then I guess the project kind of considers in a really broad sense, how do we, you know, choose to spend our time in a sort of base level of way. But I think it's also, it's for a lot of us, it's not really a choice. I mean, most of us can't really choose whether we're going to go to the job we don't like because we need to feed our families and pay for our homes or apartments or whatever. So it's kind of really looking, the project for me kind of really looks at that sort of most base level of everyday existence all the way up to sort of these, I guess, more ethereal or emotive sort of ideas of time and our experience of it.
One of the things that you did for the exhibition was you created audio and video footage of people doing performances, attempting to do it for exactly 1 minute. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like for the people doing it?
Well, I kind of did interviews with them afterwards, and it was quite a variety of reactions. And basically what I did to sort of make the source audio and video material, I invited people I knew to try to keep track of a minute as accurately as they could without, you know, a timekeeping device. And so I would do a little interview with them after. I mean, some people were actually really close to a minute. Some people were incredibly under a minute, and some people were way over a minute. But I had strange reactions. One person said, I said, well, a typical question I ask would, you know, how did you keep track of your minute? And one woman just really confidently said, oh, I just counted the seconds between subway stations in Montreal. And I thought, well, that's really great. But what makes, like, where did you ever hear that they're all 1 minute apart? So, you know, reactions that were kind of humorous like that. To other ones, I still to this day feel bad. I made one of my friends do it, and he's sort of deathly uncomfortable on camera. And so his experience, again, relating to, I think, Benjamin, his experience was this mediated through technology, and he was so upset. Like, he was just, you could just see it across his face. He was just so uncomfortable. So, yeah, there was quite a range. Some people just giggled the whole time, you know, so it was really a range of experiences, I think.
And then you've used this in three of the works as part of the exhibition, the audio and visual from this.
Yeah, I mean, and some of the work was just developed by accident. I was editing the sound one day, and I imported all of the audio recordings of all the minutes, and I just by accident hit play when they were all sort of queued up simultaneously. And so it was just this massive kind of chorus of people saying start all at the same time. But then, of course, because everybody's minute was different, after about 35 seconds was the shortest minute, a person just said stop, and then it would just sort of be the next minute of people saying these staggered stops. So that's one piece that I actually am broadcasting on a tiny little radio transmitter to sort of a field of 16 clock radios. So that's one of the pieces. And there's two other works that were developed that way. And the fourth work was actually recordings of international, a lot of governments have a national sort of, in Canada, it's the Canada Research Council has an official atomic clock that measures, you know, the vibration of cesium atoms. So it's this incredibly accurate timekeeping. So I took these recordings of time beacons and played them back through speakers placed in snare drums. And so that's another piece. It's all kind of related to the text or time and sound and silence and those kinds of ideas.
And have snare drums had a role historically in keeping time or sending signals about time?
Well, definitely drums have a history with the military, and so snare drums have a particular marching, they're a sort of one of the key drums in a marching band, you know, whose history is a military history. One of the things I was thinking about with drums is when the British were colonizing the West Indies and places like Jamaica, they started actually outlawing people, Aboriginal people playing drums, because they felt that it was communicating messages that they couldn't understand. So they just sort of had a ban on drumming, for example. So again, the drums kind of play into these ideas that I was thinking about communications and codes and sound and silence and the spaces between all those things.